From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, filling in for Terry Gross. In the new film Be Cool, John Travolta reprises his role as loan shark Chili Palmer. This time, the character wants to get into the record business. The last time we saw Chili Palmer, in the film Get Shorty, he tried his hand at the movie business. Both films were based on novels by Elmore Leonard. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Travolta and Leonard. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Best of Youth, a six-hour epic drama first shown on Italian television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Travolta has a new movie out today. It's called Be Cool, and has him playing, once again, Chili Palmer, the loan shark-turned-showbiz power player he first portrayed 10 years ago in Get Shorty. Both movies are based on novels by Elmore Leonard, and on today's Fresh Air, we'll visit with both Elmore Leonard and John Travolta, starting with Travolta. In Be Cool, Travolta's Chili Palmer is moving from the movie business to the music business. He's found a young and attractive singer he'd like to manage, and visits a club to confront her current manager, a flamboyantly dressed poser played by Vince Vaughn, and he reveals his plans.
Man, the suit. You in town for some kind of convention?
No, but if I was, you'd be the man to see, am I right?
Why would you say something stupid like that?
The way you're dressed. You're either a pimp or a limo driver.
We got jokes? You some kind of weak comedian?
Raji, look at me.
I'm looking at you, man.
Oh, you say you're looking at me, but are you really looking at me?
Well, I'm really looking at you. You got something stupid to say? Say it, so I can be done with you.
Linda's quit. She's out of the chicks.
Man, miss me with that. She's got 5 years left on a contract.
Well, I just canceled it.
I'm walking out of the dark. Who are you supposed to be?
I'm the one setting you straight. I'm Linda's new manager. Come on, honey.
John Travolta's movie career has covered a lot of years and a lot of genres. He's starred in audacious character studies like Be Cool, Get Shorty, and Pulp Fiction, disco dramas like Saturday Night Fever, lightweight comedies like the Look Who's Talking films, and action thrillers like Face Off. Terry spoke to John Travolta in 2003 when he was starring in Basic, another action thriller in which he plays a former Army Ranger called in to investigate a mysterious incident involving special forces. Terry asked him if he had to work out to become as buff as his character needed to be.
I did, only because I actually saw these ex-Rangers. I went to school with them for a week to do their exercises, and a lot of the senior guys, the guys that were teaching the trainees, were my age, and they were amazing. They were buff and in great shape, and I thought, oh my goodness, I better get to work, and I chose to be in a t-shirt and tight jeans, and I just felt like it would add to the confidence of the character, because this character, like the men I met, were very confident because they knew they were the best. They knew that they were top of their form, if you will. You know.
So does it help you if there's a real counterpart for a character? If you could go to like a real Army Ranger for your role as an Army Ranger, or you know, a real guy from Brooklyn who loves disco dancing, if you're playing that kind of role, do you need a real counterpart?
Yes.
So what do you do with a character like Pulp Fiction? You know, like
I met with three heroin addicts.
Any hitmen?
And yes, I read biographies of a couple of hitmen, and I did know of one person that would allude to this conduct and never admit it. And I spoke to him. I just heard through the grapevine that this person might, and I interviewed these people because I wasn't going to take heroin, and I certainly wasn't going to kill anybody to study these characters. So I said to one of the heroin addicts that actually was a white-collar heroin addict.
A high-functioning heroin addict.
Yes. Now, of course, both these guys that I talked to in depth were ex heroin addicts. So.
Oh, right. Okay.
I should make that clear. But I said to the one that had a better ability to communicate detail with me, I said, look, I can't do this. I won't do it. As much as I love acting and love, I'm not going to go the distance. So you must help me understand the feelings here. And he said, I can't. There's nothing like it. Blah, blah. I said, not flunk. I you have to. You have to tell me. Tell me from the onset. He said, okay, this is what you're going to do. Go home. Lay in a hot pool or bath. Get plastered on tequila. And maybe at the peak of that feeling. You will begin to feel the bottom level of what heroin is like. I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I went home and did that. And I said, okay, I got that. Now tell me where it goes from there. What happens from that point on? So then he began to describe the ebbs and flows, the valleys and peaks, in dramatic detail to me. The scratching, the feeling of warmth that came over the body, and I think crafted the moments that this was happening from the time that the character took the heroin up through his death. So he's what they called a chippy, which was kind of like a weekend heroin addict. And at any rate, he was really wonderful as far as explaining in detail what this experience was like. And then I went with a street fella who was much more kind of dramatic and kind of communicating in a way that I felt was just maybe a hair not really how it was. So I took aspects of how the street fellow talked about it and aspects of how the white collar guy talked about it. And then I put these things together and designed how this would overtake the character.
But there was this kind of hipster thing you had going there too.
Now the hipster aspect is just baggage from earlier, roles even. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So that was the beauty of a Pulp Fiction, was that you had an actor who takes very seriously his craft, and he automatically has illusions that are baggage that worked. It was kind of like putting Elvis Presley in an art film. But all of what he was about helped the imagery. And so the fact that I was willing to play this desperate character with the willingness to reveal my earlier illusions helped make that balloon float and turn what would have been a Reservoir Dogs into a Pulp Fiction, which was much more commercial and viable.
Well, let me maybe give an example of what you're talking about there, which is the twist scene when you're at the 50s diner.
Exactly.
And and there's a twist contest, which is, of course, an echo of Saturday Night Fever. And you're there.
Or Grease.
Or Grease, exactly. And you're there doing the twist. And it's an echo to your dancing roles, but you're still doing it as
but he's high on heroin and he's a hitman.
Yeah.
And yet, because of the way Quentin staged this, it was a mix of reality and fantasy that was a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
But it was all this stuff. Even with Bruce Willis, in his part, he was an action icon. And suddenly he's in a very serious art film doing the things that he does in more commercial-esque type of vehicles. So you really had a very rare and unusual... And it's probably why the movie made history.
I want to ask you about the very beginning of that scene in the 50s diner. When you walk in, you're looking for the table or for the car to sit in, because the tables are actually cars. But anyways, you're looking for the table, and you're just kind of strutting around the whole diner, looking at the posters on the wall. And it's such an interesting strut watching you do that. Can you talk a little bit about that walk?
That walk originated from what I observe people to be high from, meaning the shuffle. There was a dragging of one's feet along the ground that the effort was measured, and the feeling was like going through water, you see. And I modified his walk, and I pulled the hair down from the side because he'd been in the car, so I knew that the modified shuffle, which happened actually at the house even earlier when I pick her up, started it from when the camera was in back, because I knew the camera would be in back of me watching. And it was all those little touches that Quentin didn't even notice until he was putting the film together. That shuffle, the heroin shuffle, I call it, you know?
Uh-huh.
and the slowness in how he was observing things. And then, you know, he put his hand up like this and kind of...
Like with one finger in the air.
With one finger in the air and just was hitting the music in his own mind. So it was all like kind of in slow motion.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my version of how he was taking in the elements of this 50s kind of diner slash dance hall.
John Travolta speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. His new movie, opening today, is called Be Cool. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Travolta. He returns as the character Chili Palmer in the new film Be Cool, which is based on the novel by Elmore Leonard.
You grew up in Englewood, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Your father owned a tire distribution company. Your mother taught acting. Do I have that right?
Yes. She was a director, went to Columbia University. She taught drama. She directed. She was also a school teacher. She taught English and speech. And she was quite a marvelous character, by the way. She was very articulate and very elegant and stylish. And my father was a jock and quite appealing. He looked like Cary Grant, and she kind of looked like Barbara Stanwyck, and they were quite the two in the town when we were growing up. They were iconic in their own way in our hometown of Englewood, New Jersey.
Did she teach you anything about acting?
Yes, she did. She taught me about stage presence. She taught me stage manners.
What did she teach you about stage presence? Is that something you can really teach?
Well, no. She thought that you could never teach anyone to act, and she never thought you could really teach stage presence. What she did was that don't be afraid to take stage, which to me was a stage presence concept, meaning like if you had stage presence or not is an inborn, natural thing. But when one takes stage, that's a skill. You know, you don't deny that you're on stage. You don't deny your presence, you see. Stage manners, you know, there's basics that we were all taught. And, you know, pretending and acting is believing and all sorts of things like that. I think she liked. It was hard for her because there would be parents that would want her to teach their child to act, and she would say, I can't do that. They either have that gift or they don't, but what I can do is help hone it. And I can give them tricks and, you know, ideas that will benefit them, but I can't make them an actor if they're not.
She must have been pretty happy when she realized you had it.
Oh, my God. She just knew it. She said, oh, my God, all my life I wanted my students to be like my son. And and they're, you know, I think I was her pride and joy in that way. And she had a lot of depth. I mean, you know, she had me late, and she did have...
She was around 42 when you were born, right?
Yeah, almost
43. Which was a lot older than it is now for, now
<it's
laughs> for having a baby. Everybody,
exactly.
A lot of people do that now.
Yeah, in that day, I was her sixth, and it was unusual to have a child. Although my aunt had a baby at 46, and so it was happening.
So did you act at home? You know, were there little shows that you did at home with your brothers and sisters and your mom?
Yes, we... We had a theater in our basement, and there was wardrobe, and there was music, and there was curtains that gave us the framework to perform in. And we used it like mad. Every day we were in that theater, and we were either lip-syncing to records, or we were creating plays, and of course, Mom and Dad were the ultimate audience, as they would sit with their glass of wine and their cigarette or cigar, in my dad's case, and just cavil over us. They were just, we were the most genius things that ever hit. And I just remember hearing the comments in my, oh, Helen, can you believe him? You know, with the cigarettes going, or the certain, oh, geez, that's the best I've seen yet. You know, and who knows how good we were or not good. I just know that they thought we were the tops.
Did your mother ever draw the line for you and say, John, you're not on stage now, so just cut it out?
No.
if she thought that you were either getting too full of yourself or using your acting skills to get one over on her.
Oh,
or to
no,
play act sick was, and stay home from school.
No, she was, you couldn't bull my mother.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? She had an innate sense of reality, so she knew that. So you didn't even bother putting something over on her, you know. So I can't say that. I mean, I was precocious and demanding and that, but that was real. That wasn't my putting it on. That was just, unfortunately, the kind of child I was. I was a very dramatic child, you know, but...
Meaning what?
Well, let's see. I was just a very theatrical child. I would make demands, you know, if I didn't get certain things done by... have certain things done by certain times. My threats were to run away and to do all sorts of, you know, elaborate, dramatic things too. And they were so smart, they just let... My dad would always say, oh, he's expressing himself. I mean, any other kid would get a smack in the butt or the face, and I was always just, he's expressing himself. So I don't know if it was being the sixth, and they just had tolerance in their hearts, and they didn't mind it so much, but whatever it was... At an early age, I knew it was quite beautiful and that I was getting a big break on this not-so-ideal behavior.
Did you follow through on any of those dramatic threats?
No, but I, you know, it was pretty bad. You know, I remember once running up the stairs and throwing up the window and screaming like as though I had jumped out because something wasn't happening quick enough or something. And I can hear my mother, bum, 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 bum. And I was hiding in the closet and waiting to see how it affected her. And it affected her so deeply that I knocked it off from then on. No more dramatic behavior. It's the same thing with my father. You know, he's playing the piano one night in the store that he and his brother own. And it's honky-tonk piano. And I decided, I guess I needed some attention from him. So I'm up in the rosters in the attic of the store and I scream as though something terrible has happened to me. And boom, 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 he comes running up just like my mother had. And he holds his heart just like my mother held her heart. And these are moments where you realize how much you mean to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it was not kind. You know, I was eight, but nevertheless, I was dramatic, you know.
You grew up in New Jersey where you watched New York television and on one of the New York stations was Million Dollar Movie, which showed the same movie every day over and over for a week. So of all those movies, I'm sure you watched it. Which were the couple that you watched the most that really meant the most to you?
Yankee Doodle Dandy meant by far the most to me, period. And I watched it over and over again and I'd cry and I'd laugh and I'd sing and I'd dance and...
That's James Cagney as George M. Cohan writing.
Jimmy Cagney.
Songs at the Turn of the Century.
Yes.
And being in vaudeville.
And it was an extraordinary moment. Matter of fact, I did an expose in the New York Times, a 5-page. It was the biggest spread they'd ever done in the arts and entertainment section. And
it was part of the Watching Movies With series.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you used to watch The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
That was the other one I loved. Of course, that was almost too sad for me, but I did. You couldn't help but watch it. But it was almost too sad, you know. Symphony, water, and the beautiful girl bringing over the water and dripping it into his mouth. And of course, we would immediately take that scene and recreate it, and I'd be hunchback and put a pillow on my back, and my sister would come along with it and drip the water into my mouth.
This is after the hunchback has been pilloried and whipped and humiliated, and he's just like left there to be made a public mockery of. And the gypsy dancer gives him water after he's crying out for water.
And he's turning, they spin him around on that like Lazy Susan, like turntable thing. And he's so grotesque, but he's so sympathetic. And the beautiful girl comes over and drips the water in his mouth. And that was that was real filmmaking, truly.
John Travolta speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. He's back as the character Chili Palmer in the new film Be Cool, a sequel to the 1995 film Get Shorty. Both films are based on novels by Elmore Leonard. We'll hear from Leonard in the second half of today's show, and we'll hear more of Terry's conversation with Travolta. He tells Terry about filming the famous opening sequence to Saturday Night Fever, the sequence that features this song by the Bee Gees, Staying Alive. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. From Delacorte, publisher of Alternative Atlanta, a novel about a young man coming to terms with love, relationships, and familial obligations, by Marshall Boswell. And from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with John Travolta, and we hear from crime writer Elmore Leonard. He created the character of Chili Palmer, whom Travolta plays in Get Shorty and the new film Be Cool. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Best of Youth, a 6-hour drama first shown on Italian television. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're continuing with Terry's interview with John Travolta, whose newest movie, Be Cool, opens today. Travolta was never cooler, though, than when he strutted his stuff in Saturday Night Fever as a disco dance king. When Terry spoke with Travolta in 2003, she asked him about the indelible opening music and images from that landmark 1977 movie.
No, I have to ask you about Saturday Night Fever, which is a defining film,
sure.
Both for you and for the 70s and for American movies. The opening of Saturday Night Fever is a close-up of your feet as Staying Alive is playing on the soundtrack. And you see your feet, and then you see your feet in a hipper pair of shoes. and then you see your whole body, and then back to your feet again. When you're doing that now classic scene, which has been paid homage to I don't know how many times in other movies, did you have the music playing behind you? Did
yes.
you? So you knew the beat that you were supposed to be walking
Absolutely,
to.
And there was a debate about it. There was the producer, Robert Sigwood, wanted me to not walk down the street to Staying Alive, but to do my solo, my big dance, to Staying Alive, and to walk down the street to You Should Be Dancing. And I said, I can't do that. And I'll tell you why. I said, Staying Alive has a slower rhythm. I said, I could walk down the street to Staying Alive, but I can't dance to Staying Alive. But now I could do the solo to You Should Be Dancing because the rhythms are closer, do you know? So Staying Alive, if you remember the beat, you know, you could do a bop to that, you know, walking bop, soulful strut. But You Should Be Dancing, it was like triple time almost, you know? And that was my, he said, okay, deal. If you walk down the street to Staying Alive, I'll let you dance solo to You Should Be Dancing. I said, I'm happy.
So did you have it, were they playing it on the set as you were walking?
Mm-hmm. On a little tiny, well, it was, did you ever see those recording instruments on a set? They're kind of small and they're just what the sound man uses.
Uh-huh.
But they're almost portable looking. And that was a little apparatus connected to that. That looked like a little radio from a car or something, and a reel-to-reel recorder was being used on that, as I remember it, and it was attached to the dolly that the camera was on, and right underneath the camera was this recording apparatus.
So it kind of moved with you?
It moved with me, yeah.
So is it a walk that you practiced, or did you just know what to do?
It was a walk that I got from school. Because it was really a walk that a lot of the African-American guys that were very stylish used. And us white guys liked walking like that. So we would walk too like that to be kind of hip and, you know, with it. And I thought, I think this character would do that walk that I remembered we all did in school. Again, being in a public school where I wouldn't have necessarily gotten that from Catholic school.
Probably not.
So all my experiences that I remembered, I did bring into play there.
John Woo directed you in the film Face Off, in which you play an FBI agent, and Nicolas Cage played this crazy killer who's in prison, and through complications, much too complex for me to explain now, you trade faces through cosmetic surgery and trade identities as well. And so you end up having to do Nicolas Cage imitations, and he ends up having to do John Travolta imitations.
That's right.
When I talked to Nicolas Cage, I asked him what it was like to watch you doing him.
What did he say?
And he said, I wrote down the quote, he said, "His impression of me is pretty impeccable. He picked up the way I tend to elongate my words when I talk. I didn't know I did that."
You know, it is interesting that he didn't know he did that. I always found that fascinating. And
like, how could he not know?
In a way, you know. But I found it endeared him to me even more, because I thought, that's why Nick is so kind of wonderful, because he's not paying attention to himself. He's just being, do you know what I mean? He's not self-aware in that kind of egocentric way that one would be aware of their style, you know, or something like that. So I was pleased in an odd way that he it was a revelation to him that he did that.
What did you hear in him you picked up on, in his speech style or his movement?
Well, he's a very specific walk, which is kind of the legs bow out and they go in front of each other in kind of a, I don't even know what the comparative would be, but it's a very specific, like, outward swing that comes, and almost the toes are slightly pointed in when he does it. So the walk was very specific. And I said, Nick, we should really just go with your walk because you have a very distinctive walk. And I said, and we should go with how you enunciate and pronunciate words. And he said, oh, okay. And then I said, you know, you will make things like this. You know, you will talk, you know, and kind of, you know, and he giggled in the idea that it was, but he understood it, and so he started to comment on his own style that was pointed up to him, and then we could ride on that to some degree to see, you know. So it was a fun deal, that whole thing, trading valences in a way.
Well, he seemed to learn a lot from watching you do him. Did you learn anything from watching him try to do you?
Yeah, I learned that I'm a tough guy to imitate.
That's what he said. He said you were tough to imitate.
Because he watched all my movies, but what I have is more of a neutral personality. I don't have a lot of hooks to the way I say things or do things. And I kind of tune into characteristic traits of others in order to perform, you know. There's that old English saying about actors, they have no souls because, I mean, obviously it's not true, but I mean, they're kind of become whoever they are, so they have no identity of their own is what the saying is about, kind of. And sometimes, I mean, I don't feel that, but I understand that because I do feel neutral often before I go into a part, you know, and I maybe put a spirit of play that I have, you know, with friends or family into some aspects of a role or something, but characteristic traits I don't have a lot of specific of, and Nick does beautifully.
Okay, one last question, and if this is too weird or too personal, just tell me, but you're considered very sexy, a kind of sex symbol in a way. Does being the subject of a lot of people's fantasies and being this kind of sexual presence on screen, does that make sex any more enjoyable? I mean, does that translate to real life? Does that make lovemaking like any more exciting?
Well, I mean,
is that a weird question to ask?
No, I know what you're saying, and no, I don't have any self-consciousness about it. The question. Let me try to explain something about it.
Yeah.
So you can. I've always been a sexual person. Anyway, but not all my characters have had to use their sexuality. I felt in certain key parts I've used it, and then in others I have not. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so all I can say is in life I feel that way, but in acting I only feel that way if the character feels that way. And if there's a sexuality about the character, then I play it, and if there isn't, I don't. Do you know? And there's been, I mean, you know, there's been a certain level of sexuality in different parts I've played. And then there's some where there's just none, do you know?
But does it make you feel sexier in real life knowing that a large part of the public finds you so sexy? Do you know what I mean? Does it make you feel sexier, or does it make pleasure more pleasurable?
I don't know, because I think I felt this way before.
I see what you're saying.
The fame.
You I
see
got
what
it.
I mean?
Yeah.
I never needed the movies to feel sexy.
Got it.
You see, I think that I had the same effect on people before I made movies. And if I appealed to them personally, And I never knew whether it was just because of who I was as a person, or it was a sexual feeling they were feeling, or it was an emotional feeling that they were feeling about me. And it's very confusing sometimes because you don't know what station a person's tuning in to you on.
Uh-huh.
Is it emotion? Is it spiritual? Is it you know, sexual? Is it just commonality? Is it common realities? You know, it's a very interesting thing. But whatever it was is what I had before I started portraying that on screen.
John Travolta, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
John Travolta speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. His new movie, Be Cool, opens today in theaters. He returns to the Chili Palmer character he played in Get Shorty, which, like Be Cool, is based on a novel by Elmore Leonard. Coming up, Elmore Leonard himself. This is Fresh Air. Be Cool, the John Travolta movie that's out today, is based on novelist Elmore Leonard's book of the same name, which he wrote as a sequel to Get Shorty. Both books are built around the cocky, charismatic character of loan shark-turned-showbiz producer Chili Palmer, played on screen by Travolta. Here's how Travolta approached the character in the first film, released in 1995. Chili Palmer is sent to Los Angeles to collect a gambling debt from Harry Zim, a producer of B-movies, played by Gene Hackman. After tracking him down, Chili tries to muscle the money out of Zim.
Harry, a marker is like a check.
I know what a marker is.
They don't want to deposit yours and have a bounce. That annoys them. And your dear friend, Dick Allen's been calling you, leaving messages on your machine, and you haven't gotten back to him. So he asked me as a favor to look you up. So I follow you here, and I see you in a window with a woman. Looks a lot like Karen Flores, the actress from Grotesque. You're not looking at me, Harry.
Why do I have to keep looking at you?
Because I want you to.
So now you're gonna get rough, huh? I make good by tomorrow, you're gonna break my legs.
Come on, Harry Maces.
You tell Dick Allen I'll cover those markers in the next 60 days at the most. If he doesn't like it, then that's his problem. So, you want me to call you a cab?
So you make movies, huh?
I produce feature motion pictures, no TV. You mentioned Grotesque before. That happens to be Grotesque Part 2 that Karen Flores was in. She also starred in three of my Slime Creatures releases. You may have seen them.
I got an idea for a movie.
Terry spoke with Elmore Leonard in 1999 when his sequel to Get Shorty, Be Cool, had just been published.
One of the things that you're famous for as a writer, and this is the thing I think that makes your novels so great to adapt into screenplays, is your dialogue. It's lively, it's colorful, it's funny, and it reveals a lot about the people who are speaking it. There's a paragraph I'm going to read. It's a small thing I want to point out here, but I just really like it a lot. Let me get to the page. Okay, this is a scene in which a few of the characters are driving to a club that has swing bands performing. And I'll just pick it up here. Elliot said, guys went in there to shoot pool, and at night they had swing bands performed. One of them, Johnny Crawford, the kid that used to be on The Rifleman on TV, Chuck Connors' kid. Elliot hadn't seen the series. It was before his time, but he knew about it. Raji couldn't remember if he'd seen it or not when it was on, but he said, yeah, The Rifleman. It wasn't bad for what it was. You know what I'm saying? And I love that, the guy who can't remember at all.
Yeah,
he says, yeah, it wasn't bad for what it was. You know what I'm saying? There's something so perfect about that. It's kind of like fooling himself and fooling the other people.
Yeah, Raji probably believes what he said. Yeah, he's loaded with confidence, which is just, you know, baloney. Just, he's a street talker.
And I love the way you added that. You know what I'm saying, because to be speaking about something you know nothing about, and then ask for that's true, isn't it? You know, from somebody else, it's great.
Because I know that I'm going to move my stories with as much dialogue as possible, and this goes way back. I've always paid attention to dialogue. I've always listened. I've always made sure that each character has a different sound, an identifiable sound.
Now, you have pages that are just dialogue. There's really no exposition outside of the dialogue. And I think when you write a lot of dialogue, you get into a lot of substitutions for he said and she said. You know, he retorted, she opined, he rebuked her. I think you try to stay away from that.
Far away.
Yeah, and sometimes
I use only said. I learned something from Raymond Carver about he said using the verb said, and very, very often he Carver would use within a paragraph said two or even three times. And you know it's not for identification. It's continuing. The dialogue is continuing, but it's in there for a beat, beats, so you'll just pause a moment before the next, a bigger beat than a period, you know.
Now, you don't have to worry about the he said type of thing if you're writing a screenplay. It's just the person speaking a colon, yeah, and then the dialogue they speak.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do you like
That's
that?
That's right. Well, I don't like writing screenplays, so I stopped doing it. I had to write screenplays, but selling my material to having it optioned and bought in Hollywood and then writing screenplays supported my book writing for 15 to 20 years. But finally, I got to the point where I didn't have to write screenplays, so I didn't have to listen to all the various ideas that came off the tops of heads at story conferences, and I could just go home then, I mean, sit home then and write my book without anyone telling me what to do, and knowing that it's going to sell, I mean, knowing at least that the publisher's going to buy it, and knowing that my editor likes what I do, and knowing that I get more satisfaction out of writing a book than I ever will a screenplay, that was a simple decision to make.
If there weren't people telling you what to do in the movie world, and if you had complete independence, would you want to write more screenplays? And I ask that because in some ways you seem perfect for the part, since screenplays are dialogue, and that's something you're so good at.
I know, but it's deceiving, because when you take my manuscript, 350-page manuscript, and you bring it down to a 120-page shooting script, an awful lot of the good stuff's gone. You come down to plot. And this is what interests Hollywood, plot. And plot, to me, is not what makes my book move. It's the characters. The characters are the most important element, how they interact, who they are, what they think, even little set pieces, things that are part of their backstories. Those are all much more interesting to me than what's going to happen. What happens is not the most important thing about the book. It's how they get there. Mm-hmm. It's the ride. It's the ride, not where you arrive at.
Is there a scene in any of the recent film adaptations of your novels where you particularly like hearing the actor doing lines that are straight out of your book?
Yeah, in Jackie Brown, when Sam Jackson was trying to get, I forgot who it was, to get into the trunk of the car. And Quentin liked that so much, he even elaborated on it. The scene is longer in the movie than it is in the book. It's usually the other way around. I thought that worked extremely well.
What did you like about it?
Well, just the way they were, I just felt that these two guys were really, they were really into it. I mean, they were really doing it. They were really those characters. It was so believable to me.
Man, you must be out of your f***ing mind if you think I'm finna get in this dirty-ass trunk.
We ain't going nowhere but to Koreatown, man. You ain't gonna be in here no more than 10 minutes.
Man, I ain't riding in no g***ing trunk for no minute, man. Why I can't ride up front with you?
You can't ride up front with me. The surprise element is 90% of it.
I'm sorry, man, but I ain't getting no g***ing trunk.
I can't believe you do me like this.
Do you like what, man? I just ain't climbing in no...
How much of that was improvised? How much of it came right out of the book?
Well, I was on the set when they were shooting that scene, and they started to improvise, and Quentin said, no, stay with the lines as they're written. You can improvise later. And he made sure that the characters stayed with his dialogue. Then he would let them try things. And it was the same way with Barry Sonnenfeld in Get Shorty. The actors had to stay with the words as written. Because what happens is when actors begin to make up their own lines, they're usually lines that you thought of and discarded as being trite or too obvious. And it's funny, in story meetings, the studio executive will come up with this what he thinks is a great idea. And he doesn't realize that in writing a book over a period of 6 or 7 months, that you've thought of all these ideas. You discarded them, and you've come up with what you believe is the best idea to make the story work, you know?
Elmore Leonard, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Elmore Leonard speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. His book, Be Cool, has just been made into a movie starring John Travolta, who played the same role in another Elmore-inspired film, Get Shorty. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Best of Youth, a 6-hour epic from Italy. This is Fresh Air. The Best of Youth is a 6-hour epic originally made for Italian television. It was transferred to film and has been wowing audiences at film festivals ever since. The Best of Youth won a special jury prize at Cannes. It opened this week at the Film Forum in New York and will open wider in the coming months. David Edelstein has this review.
Marco Tullia Giordano's 6-hour saga of two Italian brothers and their extended family is one of those projects that American filmmakers occasionally attempt but never quite bring off. The Best of Youth takes place over 40 years. It's a story of individuals who grow and change amid momentous social upheavals. But there's no one-to-one correspondence between the personal and the political. I mean, it's not 1967 and the protagonist is a pot-smoking hippie, and then it's 1982 and he's an investment banker. The characters' attitudes and fashions do shift with the times, but the developments are subtle and unpredictable. More important, these characters struggle to change society. They have too much integrity to let society change them. The brothers are Nicola and Matteo, played by Luigi Locascio and Alessio Boni. It's the sharp-cheekboned heartthrob Matteo who seems the more interesting at first. He's an A student who feels injustice more deeply than anyone else, and he develops a fixation on a lovely institutionalized girl named Georgia. He ends up springing her from a mental hospital, where she's on a steady diet of electroshock, and tries to bring her to her father. But Matteo fails Georgia and abandoned his brother and two other friends, who planned a post-graduation trip north, to the North Pole, in fact. In despair, he joins the army and then the police force, while his brother, the medical student Nicola, becomes immersed in the activist counterculture. No, it's not what you're thinking. Brother against brother, one a fascist, the other a communist hippie. Nothing so cliched or allegorical or extreme like Bertolucci's 1900. Both brothers remain friends, if distant ones, and both hold true to their idealism. By the fourth hour, Nicola is a psychiatrist, successfully fighting the harsh conditions and outright torture of mental patients, while Matteo is none too successfully battling the entrenched culture of crime in Sicily and growing more and more emotionally crippled. Giordano depicts Italy as a beautiful but intractably corrupt place, and yet the characters continue to work toward transforming it. One of the brothers' friends, Carlo, becomes a banker, but one who works toward an economic system that's transparent instead of cloaked. At the other end of the spectrum, Nicola has a daughter with a beautiful woman named Giulia, played by Sonia Bergamasco. Giulia drifts into radicalism and finally goes underground with the violent Red Brigade. She's working to change the system from without. 6 hours, you think, wow, that sounds endless. But there isn't a boring millisecond. The Best of Youth isn't an art film. It's a mini-series with the sweep of a classic novel, with tons of plot. The scenes are short but penetrating. The tiniest exchanges can explode, and the five-year leaps are amazingly fluid. There's a kind of forthright lyricism in the way Giordano handles the landscape and the characters yearning for connection, for meaning, for the high spirits of their youth. It's that yearning, reminiscent of Chekhov, which holds the episodic narrative together. The suspense at times is killing, and there is one terrible shock. But there's also a fair bit of sentiment. By the sixth hour, Giordano has proven he can grapple with the harshest reality. You won't begrudge him his rather honeyed resolution. Obviously, The Best of Youth poses distribution problems. It's going to screen at art houses in two parts. You'll want to catch both in one day. Failing that, you can eventually see it on DVD. It was made for Italian television and won't suffer much. But if possible, see it in the theater. It's the sort of movie you'll recommend to friends and they'll go, 6 hours, and then thank you later. You don't need to thank me. I'm just an idealist doing my bit to make the world a better place.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rapper, producer, composer, the RZA. He's one of the founding members of the kung fu meets hip-hop group, the Wu-Tang Clan. He's also written film scores, including Kill Bill and Ghost Dog, and he's written a new book, The Wu-Tang Manual. Join us for the next Fresh Air.